Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Welcome to another episode of Staging Sound and the third installment of our series of audio papers that were submitted to our conference in Munich last September. This third installment includes two slightly more scholarly papers. They are by Maciej Gudzi, a doctoral student at the Jagiellonian University in Poland, and the second one will be by Dimitris Tsavros, who works, let me look this up, at the Liverpool John Morris University as a senior lecturer in drama. They both are concerned with the interaction of music and sound and particular productions. Maciej will talk about the collaboration of sonography and sound design in the service of affects, which is, of course, an extremely relevant and interesting topic. And Dimitris Tsavros talks about a kind of practice, research experience, his own collaboration for a production of Agamemnon at the State Theatre of Cyprus, and this is entitled Orality and Chorality in the Sonic World of Agamemnon. Enjoy these two final audio papers, and then the next episode will be a discussion of the seven audio papers we've heard over the last three episodes, so that will try to tie some of the themes, some of the topics, some of the threads and through lines together.
Imagine a stage, entirely black, almost empty, diagonally divided by a massive mirror. In front of the mirror there are several simple chairs scattered randomly. On these chairs, hunched figures sit, as if their bodies were imposed upon them. They are Masha, Irina, Olga and others, the characters from Chekhov's Three Sisters. Unlike in the original play, they appear aged, exhausted, devoid of hope. However, when Vershinin enters the stage in a wheelchair, a revitalizing energy permits them in a second. They celebrate Irina's name day, although the true source of excitement lies in the arrival of a person from the bustling city. The celebration slowly transforms into an orgy, yet one can also perceive agony within it. A deep sound, reminiscent of a chant, begins to resonate from all directions. Its intensity grows, and the acoustic wave even starts to ripple the surface of the mirror. The vibration blurs the reflection of the figures standing before it. Let's briefly listen to this sound. The scene described along with the acoustic example you have just heard is from the performance Three Sisters, staged in 2021 by the Stare Theatre in Kraków and TR Warszawa, directed by Luke Percival. This production deviates from strict adherence to the original text. The reality of the provincial setting in the twilight of the Tsarist Empire is replaced by a crisis that can be interpreted from a broader perspective, the crisis of European optimism. Several decades of peace come to an end, and the vision of progress crumbles. We observe elderly individuals saturated with nihilism. As one reviewer wrote, here time has already passed. This audio paper will focus on one of the elements of the aesthetic form of Three Sisters production, which significantly influenced the performance and intensity of its reception. To put it simple, the soundscape and scenography of the show were closely intertwined. As Erika Fischer-Lichte would probably say, the sonority of the performance directly impacted its materiality. This was made possible through the collaboration of a composer Karol Nepelski and sonographer Filip Busman, with whom I had the opportunity to speak during the preparation of this presentation. Therefore, I propose a case study. I will present their influence on the performance and inquire how this type of collaboration, culminating in a distinctive scenosonic form, affected the traditional interpretation of Three Sisters. I believe, and this is my thesis, that the composer-scenographer partnership shifted the impact of Chekhov's drama from the emotional, psychological level to the affective one. First, let us examine how scenography and musical composition complemented each other in a semiotic perspective. Philip Bussmann's set design, based on the idea of a mirror in which the characters are compelled to observe their own reflections, is conceptually simple. While for Chekhov, the province was a trap for Irina, Masha and Olga, in Percival's rendition, the stage itself becomes the prison. The punishment here is not solely captivity, but, above all, the intrusive and constant introspection forced upon the characters by the presence of the mirror. The sense of helplessness experienced by the characters, which includes both apathy and irritation, even madness, is intensified by Karol Neperski's sound design. The composer specializes in electronic music, and in Three Sisters, he also incorporated processed human voices into the composition. Prolonged ambient sounds evoking a sense of stagnation are occasionally contrasted with dissonances and distorted calls that assault the ears of both the characters and the audience. They are unpleasant, almost breaching boundaries of a body, penetrating deep beneath the skin. Thus, both sound and materiality were intended to enhance the impression of isolation when one is forced to observe him or herself. However, in several moments of the performance, their interdependence became much closer and more extensive, even tangible. The sound, as an acoustic wave, was so intense that it affected everything material: the scenography, the actors' bodies, and even the bodies of the spectators. This raises the question of how such a multisensory effect was achieved. In a physical sense, airborne vibrations transformed into material vibrations. The phenomenon itself is nothing surprising, because in fact it constantly occurs in our environment. However, in Three Sisters, deliberate efforts were taken to make this process visible. As I already mentioned, we owe it to the collaboration of the scenographer and composer. Although both artists were previously unfamiliar with each other, during one of the rehearsals, Neperski proposed placing a subwoofer behind the mirror. This was in line with the technical vision adopted by the scenographer. The reflective surface of the mirror was in fact a thin sheet of plastic mounted on a wooden frame. Due to its flexibility, the mirror did not vibrate as a whole, avoiding the risk of falling off or cracking, but it created an intriguing effect of blurring, a fluid, variable and unstable distortion of the reflection. The aesthetic form that has been born in this process was in the end incorporated into the final performance. Therefore, it was not Luc Percival who originated this idea, but Bussmann and Neperski. Let us briefly reflect on the nature of the relationship between Bussmann and Neperski described here. The collaboration of a scenographer and a composer as part of theatrical production is not common in Poland. During my research on the entanglements of sound and matter in Polish contemporary theatre, Marcin Hlanda, a highly active scenographer, even stated that he more often interacts with sound technicians than composers. He also added that sometimes these interactions are encounters between parties with conflicting professional interests. For example, the placement of microphones or the acoustics of a space does not always match the scenographer's vision. In the case of Three Sisters, Bussmann had no prior experience of directly working with sound designers. On the other hand, Neperski had previously created instruments that were also set design elements. However, during the production of The Three Sisters, they did not plan to exchange ideas. The close relationship between the visual qualities of the scenography and sound emerged as a result of accidental experiments conducted with partially developed set design and musical material. It is also crucial to consider the nature of the relationship between Bussmann, Neperski and the place director. Percival, within the framework of his artistic practice, reproduces a model of theatrical work organization where the director occupies a central position. The director is the initiator of the production, manages the performance and makes final decisions regarding its form. In the updated and reissued edition of Director's Theatre by David Brandby and David Williams, Percival is mentioned alongside creators such as Grotowski, Wilson and Stein. However, in relation to the scenosonic form that emerged in the production, Percival limited himself to accepting someone else's idea. It is worth noting that the scenographer Bussmann, who remains a permanent partner of Percival, supported this concept. Therefore, the aesthetic shape of the performance was the result of an organizational alliance between two often completely separated theater jobs. Considering the aforementioned collaboration, what impact did it have on the reception of Chekhov's drama? Let's now explore the influence of the intricate interplay between sound and scenography on the interpretation of the performance. Chekhov is renowned for his profound psychological insights, diligently exploring the emotional lives of his characters. He sought tensions in everyday and ordinary human relationships, and more eagerly in the experiences of individuals. As James N. Lachlan states in the Cambridge Introduction to Chekhov, The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, Three Sisters and The Cherry Orchard are unrivaled in their combination of naturalistic detail, psychological insight and poetic intensity. Similarly, David Allen in performing Chekhov quotes a researcher from the beginning of 20th century. Chekhov had transferred the center of gravity in his drama from the external to the internal, from the acts and events of external life to the internal psychological world of his characters. Therefore, Chekhov presented a challenging task for actors. They had to embody something that cannot be verbalized. Sound had slightly helped them. As Nick Worrell's research demonstrates, music played an important role even in the Moscow premiere of Three Sisters. In his article, Stanislavski's production of Chekhov's Three Sisters, Worrell refers to the sound effects prepared by the theater as mute music. Its purpose was to help the audience understand the state in which the characters found themselves. However, does Percival achieve the same effect, and does the sound having impact on scenography serve the same purpose? The emotional turbulence accompanying the characters in specific scenes, unspoken, accumulated and exhausting, undoubtedly found visual representation in the blurred reflection of the mirror. Its vibration could also be an interpretation of Chekhov's depiction of the disintegration of the world in which the events of the drama unfold. Nevertheless, we cannot overlook a crucial component of any performance, the audience's perspective. Let us remember that the frequency and intensity of the sound not only moved the flexible mirror, but were also felt by the gathered audience. The vibrations affected both the seats on which the spectators sat and their bodies. It synchronized them with the mirror membrane and the actors. The experience of senosonic form proposed by Neperski and Busman was therefore much deeper than solely relying on the sense of hearing and sight. The reception of the composition also had a haptic character. Vibrations were felt on the skin and even within the body. I believe that Brian Massumi's theory of affect provides a useful framework for explaining the principles underlying these effects in Percival's production. Thanks to his insights, humanists gained a useful tool for differentiating between the order of signification and the parallel order of intensity that characterizes affective reception. Intensity, as Massumi describes it, is a non-conscious, never-to-be-conscious, autonomic reminder. It is outside expectation and adaptation, as disconnected from meaningful sequencing, from narration, as it is from vital function. It is also worth noting that for Massumi, affect has a synesthetic character, meaning it can be felt especially where the senses interact with each other. In the case of Percival's Three Sisters, the creators aimed to maximize the impact of the production by engaging multiple senses in the perception of cohesive sounding senosonic forms. Thus, Chekhov's explorations were expanded and deepened. Contrary to the commentators who focused on the character's internal experience and the expression of emotions, Percival's performance reveals that the issue is more complex. It shows that external communication can occur not only at the level of semantically and semiotically expressed emotions, but also through a circulating set of stimuli that are difficult to grasp, functioning at a purely physiological level. In the Three Sisters show, these stimuli, explicit but not easily nameable, were evoked by integrated sound and set designs. In this way, the audience not only observed and named the emotional states they perceived in the actors' expressions, but also underwent processes that dislodged them from the safe, distanced position of the interpreter. Overall, then, the collaboration between the composer and scenographer resulted in a synesthetic, acoustic, visual, and haptic communication for which the ordinary spectators became a community connected by affect, confronted with a crumbling world.
The theatre organisation of Cyprus' first ever production in 1971 was Aeschylus' Agamemnon, and the play was staged again in 2021 as part of the celebrations marking the organisation's 50th anniversary. The Greek tragedy was directed for the first time in Thorpe's history of summer productions by a female director, Lea Maleni, and I was part of the creative team as composer and musical director. Touring exclusively in open-air theatres, both in rural and urban settings across the southern part of the island, the premiere was set in the capital's amphitheatre Makarios III, situated at the center of Nicosia. Amidst the in-between of the geopolitical and cultural sound tapestry, faintly emerging from the distance, are sounds of other gatherings and alternative summer festivals, accompanied by the murmuring assemblages of singing cicadas, the faint bustle of traffic, the occasionally resounding Christian church bells, and intermittent calls to prayer from a nearby mosque. The sounds intertwine in mergers and counterpoints as they rise from the ceaseless hum of the city, only to recede back into it, to fade and reappear in series of undulating waves. Sound, orality, and vocality hold significant importance within the context of this tragedy, the first part of the Oresteia trilogy. This realization emerged early during the initial stages of research on the classic text, the modern Greek translation chosen, and extensive discussions with the director and creative team, initially on lengthy Zoom meetings across different countries and slightly offset time zones. The primary objective of the team was to employ a tangible understanding of the text in order to explore its resonances with a contemporary audience, an audience at the threshold of a post-truth world shaped by the new realities of the pandemic and the discourse around it, critical questions surrounding evolving geopolitical landscapes, borders, refugee identities, and ongoing international conflict and warfare. Like their Athenian counterparts and the Argive chorus, very much aware of the abuses of power and corruption, particularly salient in this in-between stage of transitioning, one filled with internal contradictions and acts of justice that are simultaneously acts of injustice. Sound would be one of the primary theatrical layers tasked to create the resonances between contemporary reality and the world of the tragedy. As I delved into the understanding of what many scholars deem as the most complex persona of all tragic choruses, the function of the chorus became the principal locus of my investigation, together with how the elusive notion of chorality might be approached in a contemporary staging of the play. The complexity of the chorus in Agamemnon rests primarily in the way it departs from traditional forms of collective utterance, but perhaps this presented a significant creative opportunity. Beyond expressing a collective singular voice, the voice of a community, as Judith Fletcher indicates, studied as a series, the choral odes in Agamemnon reveal the increasingly shattered unity of a conventionally unified persona. We do not expect the tragic chorus to be divided in its opinion, but this one is. In the face of disaster, and especially when it needs to make a decision, it fragments into indecision and multiple voices. In tracing the journey of this socially heterogeneous group, Fletcher notices their gradual move through different types of polyphony to their complete silencing in the Exodus, after the tyrant Aegisthus' threats. This so unconventional instance of the chorus's fragmented dispersion around the scene of the murder and their inaction in the face of an act of violence struck a chord. Drawing from Fletcher's analysis, the musical dramaturgy focuses our attention to this rather climactic moment. In the overall plan for the composition of the choral score, I move from homophonic musical textures to gradually more polyphonic ones, until the moment of choral silence that ensues their ultimate disintegration. A deafening silence aiming to become aurally the metaphor for inaction. The aim of the musical composition, as I will try to explicate in the following analysis, is to expose the chorus not as a separate, singular and distant commentator or ideal spectator to the main story of the protagonists, but as a polyvocal group that holds the power of an active agent. The tension between the individual and the collective is at the center of the investigation. To this effect, the sound design and music composition were not conceived of as separate elements or processes in the production. Sound, voice, and music are considered on a continuum that aims to create a sonic world that elucidates exactly the political dimension of the chorus through this particular manifestation of chorality. The play with sound, voice, and music on an aesthetic level is primarily conceived so that it actively unsettles the boundaries between these categories and uses the productive space in between them to pose questions around the hierarchies that different types of soundings and voicings potentially pertain to.
The chorus enters after the prologue, slowly accompanied by an enveloping and developing block of sound, which engulfs them and their voices as they preemptively speak and sing fragments from the performance that is about to unfold. Their voices surface from the sound, which appears to give birth to their unending ritual mourning, a constant murmuring song of lamentation.
The sound world can be broadly divided between the live vocal sounds performed by the chorus on stage, on the one hand, and the pre-recorded acousmatic sounds emanating from the speakers. The pre-recorded sound layer, intentionally simple in instrumental color, included two main components, a piano track and the soundscape we labeled the block of sound. This block of sound aimed to create the impression of an entity that was almost alive, that was ever-evolving and always inconspicuously omnipresent, even when we were not fully conscious of hearing it or uncertain whether it was there. Its aim was not to underline the episodes emotionally, other than perhaps to create an atmosphere of a constant sense of suspension in time, a constant waiting for something, an enduring anticipation of a resolution, perhaps a solution provided by an ex machina of sorts. This acousmatic soundscape reappeared many times in the performance in different guises, changing from a single pitch drone to a rather broad and complex spectrum of clusters that evolved in texture and frequencies. The block was very much inspired by the cityscape, so that it acted as an open invitation for it to become part of the theatre experience. Because it resembled the undulating living murmur of the city, this accommodating sound entity seemed to both absorb and assimilate the sounds around the theatre. No sound effects per se were utilised in the performance outside the accidentally occurring sonic events that entered the open theatre, blurring the line between the real and the dramatic polis. The block was composed out of an overimposition of several recordings of melodicas and accordions, instruments based on breath or air production, to provide a contrapuntal texture and a feeling of uncertainty in antithesis to the mechanical, percussive, well-tempered piano sound. The two pre-recorded sound elements together were also envisaged to emulate and augment the spectrum possibilities produced by the choral voices. The block's air-sustained drone that microtonally moves or tunes in and out of focus created a disorientating feeling, especially as it moves from the individual to the collective. This device extends into the musical language of the miroloi, the lament, and the elements of religious and folk rituals which infuse the choral writing in the Stasi. Since our initial conversations, the director had suggested a blend of a rather minimalist musical language with the incorporation of folk elements from a variety of different traditions, and this became one of the starting points in my experiments to find the compositional palette. The idea of ritual has been widely considered in contemporary stagings of tragedies, especially in the Greek context. There is a long tradition, particularly post-80s, of finding equivalent contemporary rituals in the Christian Orthodox and folk rural traditions to frame the staging and provide plausible solutions for the chorus's lyric language. While I'm borrowing from this tradition, my intent was to also critically interrogate it. Translating the directorial suggestion into the musical dramaturgy I was building, the Stasima were through composed to create a general sense of entering a ritual space-time that slightly separated them from the more narratively driven episodes, but also to intentionally create an overload of sound that developed as a consequence. A constant, nagging, ever-evolving soundscape of complaints and accusations that never stops until the moment of crisis when it appears to be ineffectual, a ritualistic form of a constant lamenting murmur which exists in and beyond language, which simmers polyphonically under each word and perhaps allows words and thoughts and arguments to shape from its indistinct mass of sound as it takes on shapes and refrains that are cited repeatedly, semantically indistinct at the beginning, but formulating and surfacing concretely over time. The overarching plan for the musical dramaturgy provided the skeleton upon which musical ideas sketched in the period before the start of rehearsals would be tried out subsequently with the ensemble of actors in the studio and developed accordingly. The musical themes and ideas gradually developed in response to the group of actors cast in the chorus and their particular strengths, but also, crucially, in collaboration with a choreographer, especially as the placement and movement of non-amplified singing actors in an open-air theatre was rather important. The mechanics of the sound world was further conceived on the premise that orality and vocality are dramaturgically essential in relation to providing evidence for decodification. The reluctance of the chorus to be convinced by oral evidence is interspersed throughout the text, but is especially poignant first in their inability to understand and accept Cassandra's prophetic pronouncements before she knowingly enters the palace to join Agamemnon, and even more so their incredulity to the actual sounds of the double murder that consequently takes place inside. In fact, questioning the credibility of aural evidence as an inadmissible form of witnessing and knowing is used by some chorus members as a reasoning for their subsequent inaction. As noticed by Fletcher following Lebeck, the connections between different parts of the trilogy are part of a dynamic semiotic system in the Oresteia. Images from the symbolic register gradually move from abstraction to concrete reality. This movement between the two becomes rather central in building the aesthetics of a polysemic orality, which moves between sound, music, and voice. Interestingly, the second choral ode almost exemplifies this idea in suggesting a connection between Helen's name and the disaster she is seen as responsible. The choral ode begins with a question, which I set in slow homophonic texture as an introduction to the rest of the stasis. Who handed out names in such a way that they come true? The modern translation uses the alliteration of Eleni, Helen, with Aneleidi, meaning without mercy, to create the connection. In setting this stasis to music, I took the alliteration to an extreme, introducing a variety of very similar words and short phrases that sonorically connect Helen's name to the merciless disaster caused, as well as the act of speaking or telling stories and spreading rumors, which the chorus makes reference to, I slowly built an ostinato of a developing contrapuntal polyphonic choral texture very much aligned with the aggressively accusatory tone of the stasimo as discussed with the director, and taking inspiration from the meter and polyrhythmic structures of a perihios, a dance connected with war. Compositional language constantly plays with the boundaries between semantically concrete and abstract vocalizations and reveals relationships between them. In further exploring the continuum between sound and voice, the chorus often take on non-verbal, instrumental-like musical passages that intend on blurring the lines between voice and instrument, background and foreground, meaning and effect. The more the voice submits to the deterritorializing force of music by offloading the linguistic components of language, the more it becomes a musical instrument, suggests Alex Novitz. But operating beyond linguistic semantics always implies a political dimension. This evolving polyphonic musical instrument that the chorus transforms in for each of the stasima is not an aesthetic abstraction devoid of semantic weight, nor of political significance. While I'm borrowing from an aural tapestry that mixes minimalism with Byzantine influences, folk, traditional elements and Middle Eastern modes and melismas to build a sense of ritual for each one of the stasima, the instrumentation is rather unconventional. The sound texture of the piano and the choice of a rather domesticated polyphonic Western instrument is rather jarring, both in the context of the sound world the music borrows from and the open-air theatre context. The alienating quality of the instrumentation here is aurally significant. The rather machinic-sounding piano draws attention to help further deterritorialize the percussive choral polyphony into an almost comparable instrument. Collaborating with the sound technicians, we reconfigured the more conventional stereo placement of the speakers on either side of the orchestra to a singular speaker bundle at the back of the palace. This helped practically with the balance between amplified sound and unamplified voices, but also suggested both a significant hierarchy and a potential political connection between the two instruments. If the pre-recorded sound of the piano emanates from behind the structure of the palace to conduct the live voices of the chorus, maybe the instrumentalization of these voices refers to a more significant metaphor about their culpability in the cycle of corruption and power abuse sustained by the state. Stasimon III is the last choral ode before the climactic murder scene. The passage connects the act of singing this ritual, sad and fearful reiterative song to a learned behavior, and also seeks to attribute responsibility to somebody for it. Who taught me this song? They ask. The inability to take personal responsibility and action, and the search for someone or something else who would provide the solution and act on their behalf, is quite central in the enunciations of the chorus. This refrain and the question of political responsibility becomes a focal point and the guiding factor in choosing which text in the Stasima I would set musically in order to highlight this idea. The motif was developed musically in a way that it builds to a climax in the third Stasima, the last time the chorus will sing before the moment of inaction. The interrogative question arrives at a frenetic climax when a group of chorus members sing the word "who" (pios) on the longest note sung in the performance, held on top of the underlying fork-like ostinato. The sonoric clash that is formed vocally at the climax references indexically the instrumental block of sound that has been lingering almost like a spectre of an invisible character. Following that choral climax, the acousmatic sonority of the block will mirror it in its most intense resurgence as the audience witness the blood-clad bodies of Agamemnon and Cassandra lying on the ekeklima rolled on the stage. The persistent question of who is responsible and who will provide the solution might not be definitively answered. But through these compositional choices and aural connections, the sonic world is instigating some further thoughts. How implicated is the chorus in the cycle of corruption that we assume is the fault of the elite few, the state, the invisible other that we seem to blame? How implicitly culpable for the perpetuation of fear and the hierarchies it supports is the chorus because of the reiterative rituals it participates in? The clues exist between sound, voice and music, which corroborate in asking questions in dialogue with but beyond the text. Ultimately, I'm asking the audience to attend to the sound world not only through the participation in a methexis-inducing ritual, but through an interrogation of the aural evidence presented to reconsider the politics of rituals and the ways the chorus's performance might be pointing to new questions about contemporary democracy and the tensions between the individual and the collective.
So again, a huge thank you to Maje and Dimitris for their stimulating papers. You can find more detail about their papers and about, both the audio paper authors in the show notes of this episode, as always. I'm looking forward to welcome you all back for the summary discussion of these last three episodes in the next episode. Until then, goodbye.